What's the dark side of metal detecting?
What does working the land on a British scheduled site involve?
And what did the people of the past want to happen to their bodies after they died?
It's time for another episode devoted to answering your questions here on the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek. This episode is about answering your questions, and thank you so much for getting in touch with them. There have been so many. We've got a new way of asking questions as well now. You go onto Patreon, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and then you can click on the chats bit, which is sometimes in the community section, and there's just an obvious chat that is permanently running where people are asking their questions, and I've been scrolling up and down that, finding questions from you to Helen. Also coming up on this episode, by the way, we've got another edition of Helen's Find. Helen is going to give you a find, a discovery, an object that tells a story, and we'll discuss that in just a little bit. And they've all been really interesting so far in the other ones that we've done of them in previous podcasts. So we get on to your questions in just a moment. I thought we could just talk very briefly, though, Helen, about Sutton Hoo, because we're going to be there very, very soon. We're really excited about that. The episodes from our previous dig there in 2024 have been going out on YouTube over the last little while. And we now can talk about the ending, because what a moment that was. If you've not seen it yet, this is a bit of a spoiler, so make sure you go and watch on YouTube before listening to what we're about to say here. But throughout the episodes, we are on the hunt, really, for this mysterious metal detecting signal that was coming from an area of the trench that we were excavating. We thought, oh, could it be the remnants of this Byzantine bucket? And it was. What a moment that was when it came out of the ground.
I know. And really, you know, it was more than we could have hoped for, because you always hope that you're in the right place, that you've done as much reconnaissance as you can to begin with, but in the end all you can do, there's this awful term, all you can do is poke and hope. You know, you have to just hope you are in the right place to find the thing that you're going for. Normally with Time Team we have the geophysics and so on, and we know that we're going to find something because there's something in the geophysics. But when you're going for the find spot of something before, whether it's an object or whether it's a feature that isn't going to show up in the geophysics or is going to be very difficult, you don't know quite where you're going to be. And we didn't know if this bucket had been pulled up by a harrow from being dropped by previous excavators, grave robbers. We didn't know if it had been hit by the service trench. In the end, neither of those turned out to be true. But the fact that we did actually manage to recover the rest of it, and we now have another complete Byzantine brass bucket, it was just so lucky. Can we possibly be as lucky this year in putting it in context and working out exactly what is happening in Garden Field before, what is happening there to results 100 years later in the Sutton Hoo Mound Cemetery being placed right next to it? That is our key ask for this year. Can we be as lucky this year as we were last year?
And what are the, because obviously a lot of work has been done before spades go in the ground and trowels go in the ground, whatever. How likely is it that we are going to get the answer to our questions this year?
Well, this year's question is a much bigger question. It's a much more open-ended question. And so I think it's I think it's a lot less likely. But if you'd asked me last year how likely it is that we would actually find the rest of the Broomsar bucket, I would probably have said not terribly likely. I think that the idea that you might, even in quite a big trench like that, come down precisely on the place where you wanted it to be wouldn't be very likely. But Sutton Hoo is an extraordinary site all round. It is never what you expect it to be. And so whatever we find, whether we get the answer to the question we're looking for, or a partial answer, of course, because this is a big question, or whether it throws up more questions and makes us realise that the site is a different animal altogether, it's impossible to say.
Well, on the next episode of the podcast, by the way, if you are interested in learning more about the bucket and what we know about it, I recorded an interview when we were out there, sort of right next to the, you know, the first bit that was discovered. You just get to learn so much more about it as part of that conversation, which you will hear on next week's podcast. So, and that will be the one just before we go back. So it'll set you up nicely for the next bit to come, which is going to be good. Anyway, let's put Sutton Hoo to one side for just a moment and get to your Patreon questions. And thank you so much for these. They're always really enlightening. Des Carter's been in touch with, I think, a question that a lot of people ask today and have probably been asking for centuries and millennia into the past. And that is, what do you want to happen to your body after you die? And Des says, which was cheaper? What he actually says is, which was cheaper, inhumation or exhumation? I think, well, is it cremated or being buried, basically? Which is the cheaper is, I think, what Des is trying to ask.
That's an interesting question. And a lot of the time people think, well, cremation doesn't involve all those grave goods, does it? Because you can't see so many of them. And so you think to yourself, well, cremation, inhumation is where you get the great grand assemblages of grave goods like Sutton Hoo, like Prittlewell, and so on and so forth. And cremation, often all you can see is maybe a melted glass bead and a bit of iron. But of course, you have to think about the wood for the pyre. You have to think about building the pyre. You have to think about the person who's got the knowledge to keep it burning until the body has been completely consumed by the fire. And you've got the pot, which is often a very ornately decorated pot with sometimes freehand drawing on it, or sometimes freehand drawing in the wet clay, or often stamps. The main thing to remember is that although you can't see the grave goods on a cremation a lot of the time, they were still there. It's just that they've melted away to tiny little fragments that in the past often weren't recognised. Tiny bits of melted bead. The amber could go completely. Little droplets of copper alloy, which might not be noticed. A lot of the time, the only things that people found in older excavations were iron tools that were put into cremation burials. And other things like weapons, there's no room for in a cremation burial. We still don't really know whether not having a weapon is a deliberate choice in a cremation burial, or whether it's a practical thing, as in there isn't the space, we don't put it in because it's a smaller thing. It's the actual final burial of the cremated body and the grave goods and the pot in the pit is a much smaller thing.
Right now, in the society we live in today, you get a choice between the two. You know, some people decide they want to be buried, some people decide they want to be cremated. Would that have been the case in, you know, Anglo-Saxon times, or would it have been everybody did one or everybody did the other?
It's not quite as simple as, it's not a binary choice. There are some cemeteries where everybody is cremated, and they are often enormous, you know, thousands of people buried there. And there has been a theory that because cremation is technically quite difficult, you have to have these experts, that if you wanted to be cremated, you would have to, or you wanted to, your relative to be cremated, then you would have to go somewhere where somebody knew what they were doing. Therefore, people would come together from a large area and you'd get these very big burial grounds. That doesn't necessarily entirely work out, because obviously it's much easier to transport the urned burial than it is to transport the dead body to the pyre. So it could be that people are being cremated in their communities and then the pot is being taken to this central place. We don't know. And that is something that we might be able to work out from analysis of cremated remains from these huge cemeteries retrospectively, that they're already in museums and they just need that bit of work doing on them. So you get, on the one hand, these huge cremation cemeteries, not many of them. And then you get also large cemeteries that are only inhumation. And what I should have said about the cremation cemeteries is they're in the East Anglia and Lincolnshire and East Yorkshire. you get large inhumation cemeteries where nobody's cremated, and that doesn't seem to be an option often in other places like Hampshire and Wiltshire and so on. But you also get a mix in some other cemeteries. So even somewhere like Spong Hill, which is one of the most famous cremation cemeteries with over 2,000 cremations, there are a few inhumations. Not many, but there are some. A lot of the cemeteries in Suffolk have a mix, and it seems as if you could decide. But to turn the question a bit round, Martin, these days, how do we decide whether we're going to be cremated or buried? We don't really know, do we? We've got a kind of weird gut feeling that one of them or the other one is in some way right, but we don't often know why.
No, and I suppose a lot of the time it can be informed by maybe your religion or the culture that you are a part of. Or you're right, just a sort of personal feeling about what we want to happen to us after we die.
Mm.
And sometimes it can be cost. Sometimes it can just be, well, what's the cheapest thing? Because you're worried about your family having to pay that cost, and so you think to do the cheapest thing.
Yes, the simplest, the easiest, for whatever reason. Yeah, and the religious question is quite an interesting one, because there was a suggestion quite a few years ago now that maybe it was something to do with the Anglo-Saxon god that you felt the most allegiance to. You might imagine that the two really big gods in the Anglo-Saxon world are Woden, who everybody's heard of, and there's this slightly older, more powerful, more grown-up kind of god called Tew, who's from Tuesday. You know, they're Tuesday and the Wednesday gods, Tew and Woden. Tew is a god of war. He's slightly different. He's slightly more Germanic. And there was a suggestion that maybe if you felt that Tew was your god, you'd be cremated. And if you felt that Woden, the slightly more cosmopolitan and modern and up-to-date kind of god, was your god, you'd be inhumed. But I think that that may be a bit anachronistic and maybe a bit based on what we think today. We tend to feel that death, particularly in the Christian world, is really bound up with religion, because Christianity is really focused on the afterlife. But we don't necessarily think that the Anglo-Saxons, the pagan Anglo-Saxons, were that focused on the afterlife. They saw death as a big mystery. It's really hard to say. And I think that asking and answering that question maybe tells us a bit more about us than it does about what was really going on in the past. It doesn't make it any less interesting. In fact, I think it makes it more interesting.
A great question. Thank you, Des. Enjoyed that one a lot. Let's move on to question number two from Ben, which we've almost talked a little bit about this already. In a previous podcast, says Ben, you talked about the positives of metal detecting. I would like to ask about the dark side. What threat to archaeological sites do unethical detecting practices cause, and what is and or should be done about this on a county and national level? Well, we've already talked about the wonderful things that metal detecting does in this episode already, because they blinking found that bucket in we couldn't have done it if we hadn't had that metal detectorist there. Keith was there making sure, we're getting that signal here, this is where you want to be digging. We had that confirmation. But there is, I'm afraid to say, a bit of a dark side to metal detecting, and it's only fair that we talk about it whilst also celebrating the brilliant side of it as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the thing that distinguishes the dark side from the light side, if you like, is whether it's done ethically or not. If you're doing your metal detecting unethically or even unlawfully, then there's two really major pieces of damage you can do to the archaeological record. And the first one is, of course, the issue of digging holes to recover objects without looking at the rest of the site. This was really the reason why Mick Aston, in the early days of Time Team, he felt that, he was really against any kind of metal detecting. He felt that it was all unethical, because he felt that the objects that were taken out of the site were useless, and that the site with the objects removed from it, it was irretrievably damaged. And he was right about that. But he wasn't perhaps looking at the full picture. Ethical metal detecting just looks at the topsoil, where the context of the finds has already been destroyed. So all of those things like the soil and the stones and everything that makes up an archaeological site has already been damaged by ploughing. And therefore, the objects are the only thing of that site that survive. And therefore, it is an ethical thing to do to take them out and record them because they are the only bit of the site that can be studied. So if we look at somewhere like Wynfarthing, that is very much a site that is only known about from its objects. And Time Team, kind of when we went there, we revealed what would have been there almost rather than what had been there. It was just the tiny little bits that survived. But moving on to the second thing, and one that is just as serious, if not more serious, is the loss of knowledge. Because if you're metal detecting unethically or illegally, you're obviously very unlikely to report your finds to the Portable Antiquities Scheme. So they don't get recorded. We all lose the information about them and about where they were found, which is the most crucial thing. And that's a loss to every single one of us. Once the information has gone, you can't get it back again. But as for what we should do about it, well, that, you know, it's easier to state the problem than it is to say how we can fix it, because if we could fix it, we'd have fixed it long ago, I think. We are having a go, and at the local level, we're already working with police. We talk to the police in rural crime squads because they're the ones out on the ground who can catch detectorists who are on site without permission. And they're developing really good ways of doing this with night vision and drones and so on. So in the past,
but yet they don't have the resources to be at every field on every site at all 24 hours a day.
Yes. And the one thing we really don't want them to do is if somebody rings 999 and they rock up with a siren on, I mean, you're not going to catch anybody that way. They have to work largely on intelligence, and then they can stake places out. So the intelligence is the really important thing. And at a national level, we've got the Metropolitan Police's Art and Antiques Squad, and they work very much on intelligence, and they can spread it out to the local police. But what they really do is they tackle the market in illegal objects. And I think the thing that we should be doing more of, the way that we'll really tackle it, is to educate the people who are ultimately driving this, who are the collectors who feed the market by pouring money into it. If nobody bought these things, then nobody would be trying to steal them.
It's similar as well to the ivory trade. And how on earth do you stop poachers going out and shooting animals in order to get their ivory when that ivory is worth an awful lot of money on the black market, and that might be able to feed a family in a very poor country for a very long time? It is a really difficult battle, and even education doesn't always do it. It's a really, really interesting topic, and I think one that we will have to return to, because there's a lot to be said. And we don't, by the way, want to say that all metal detecting and all metal detectorists are terrible people. That is absolutely not the case at all. There are some really brilliant and very ethical metal detectorists who are out there who do wonderful work, and without whom we couldn't find a lot of the sites that Time Team goes out and excavates. And some of the sites that have been discovered have been as a direct result of metal detectorists enjoying their hobby and their work.
Yeah, and they help to monitor them for plough damage. Absolutely. You know, a metal detector is just an instrument. It's the people that use them that make it a force for good or a force for bad.
Something definitely to think about there, I reckon. Thank you very, very much for the question. Back to the questions in just a moment. First, though, it's time for Helen's Find. This is the bit of the podcast where Helen suggests an object, a discovery that maybe has an interesting story to tell. And you're going back to an old Time Team dig for this one.
I am, yes, because I thought, well, we've done a lot of Portable Antiquities Scheme finds. And although we do have, you know, literally millions of them on our database, they are all, almost all, with completely without context. And I thought we'd go back to a Time Team find that did have a context and has really changed the way we record these objects on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. I want to take you back to Codner Castle. Now, this was a site that became famous because it was the first gold coin that was found on a Time Team. It might even have been the first piece of gold that was found on a Time Team, and it caused a lot of excitement. It came out of the moat, and whoever dropped it in the moat would have really rued the day that they did that, but there's no getting it back once you've dropped a gold coin in the moat. Something else that came out of the moat was a decorated lead spindle well, and I got even more excited about this object because it was, until we found that one in the moat, we had no idea of their date. it's a measure of how little anybody else thought of it, that going back to the Wessex Archaeology report on Codner Castle, it isn't even illustrated. So I think, Martin, you're going to put the link to the Wessex Archaeology report.
I will, yeah.
But also add a link to a similar one on the Portable Antiquities Scheme, just so you can see what they look like. They can't be dated by their decoration. They've got these ribs and pellets on them, which just form patterns, geometric patterns that aren't like medieval art. They are a bit more like Roman art. You know, you often get geometric patterns on mosaics, for instance. So for a long time, it was thought that they were Roman, but we had no real idea. And I suppose I ought to stop at this point and explain what a spindle whirl is, what it's for. They were used in spinning yarn before the invention of the spinning wheel. And the spinning wheel, I think, was invented roughly in the 16th century. I'm not really very clear on that. But drop spinning, which is the technique beforehand, was used up until around the 16th century. So in order to do this, you get a stick, which is the spindle, which I think is where we get the term spindly from. So if you're very thin and spindly, you're like a spindle. So it's a long, thin thing. You set it spinning and then you drop it. And the spindle whirl acts as a weight, like a flywheel that keeps it spinning round and round and round and round, making this spin very even and quite tight. And the drop spindle apparently works better in some ways than a spinning wheel, but it is very, very labour intensive. So the whirl keeps it whirling round. These things are pretty common as metal detector finds, which is why it was important to date them. I mean, it's okay if a few things we find we can't date, but there are thousands of lead spindle whirls on the Portable Antiquities Scheme database, and a lot of them are decorated.
And why would you decorate one? It's just a practical object, isn't it?
Well, you have to cast them. They're made out of cast lead, and the lead is useful because it's so heavy, but they're made in a lot of other materials as well. And in fact, there's a lovely little sentence in an old Anglo-Saxon cemetery report where they're discussing whether a bead would have been used as a spindle whirl, where the excavator quotes some old lady somewhere who has spent all her life spinning with a potato because it does the job just as well. And the Anglo-Saxons, of course, wouldn't have used potatoes because they didn't know about potatoes, but they might well have used something like an apple or a stone or a wooden one, not so heavy, so not so good. They did also make them out of stone or out of reused potsherds. Often a piece of Samian ware was reused because it's a lovely, smooth, attractive object. So they decorated them because they just like to have nice things in their lives, I suppose, the same way as anybody does. But the problem was that literally none of them had ever been found in an archaeological context except for one, which had come from Leicester, from the site of the Austin Friars. And this was difficult on two grounds. One was that it wasn't the same decoration. It was inny decoration instead of outy decoration, if you see what I mean. It was cast in rather than standing proud. And also Leicester, well, that is the last place you would want to sort out a date for something that could be Roman or could be medieval, because it's an important place in the Roman period and it's an important place in the medieval period. So it could easily have been a residual find. It was not considered to be an object that answered the question, that sorted out the problem. The Codner Castle one was, because there was no Roman activity anywhere near and it came from a, you know, right down in the moat of a medieval castle. That sorted out the date of the decorated ones, and that spurred me on to do a bit of research on the undecorated ones, which look to those of us who work with metal detectorists as if those are the common ones, because those are the ones we record because they're made of metal. So we don't record any of the, or very few of the ones that are made of pottery or stone or whatever, because they don't get found by the detectorists. So I started combing through loads and loads and loads and loads of excavations, and I did find a very few instances of lead spindle whirls, not from the Roman period, but from places like Norwich and medieval contexts in London, enough to show that they were used in very small numbers through the medieval period from about the 10th century. So they're pre-conquest and they go right up to the end of this drop spindle spinning in the 16th century. So that one find at Codner Castle, unlocked the dating of thousands of these things on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. So it made a real difference, much more so than the gold coin.
And if you want to go and see the sort of thing that we're talking about, there are two links that I've left for you in the description of this podcast. One is the report from Codner Castle that Helen mentioned, and the other is a similar type of spindle wall, which you can go and look at on the Portable Antiquities Scheme. And there you go, another edition of Helen's Find. This is the Time Team Podcast, Martin Williams and Dr. Helen Geek answering your questions. Thank you so much for getting in touch with them. A really easy way to do it now on Patreon. You just go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. Thank you so much for supporting us there. Hopefully you're enjoying all of the extra bonus content that you get as part of being a kind person who wants to support the archaeology that we do as part of Time Team. And you get to ask a question via the Communities tab. Just click on Chats and you'll be able to ask a question there. There have actually been, Helen, this time some questions for me, which was not the point of this at all. Doug got in touch. A question for Martin, who's eager to learn more about archaeology and who's getting some great hands-on archaeological experience along the way. What would be Martin's favourite archaeological trip to date? And what does he hope to pursue and learn about? A great question. Doug Conan has also got in touch. Martin, I have a few questions for you. When you signed on with Time Team, what were you expecting? And has your experience so far met those expectations? Do you know what? I will say in answer to these questions, Doug, I'll answer your question sort of directly. And just by saying that my favorite one was the first one, because everything was new to me. I arrived, this was before I'd even sort of said, yeah, let's do this podcast and make this. It was literally come on a dig. And it was the Corfe Castle one. And it was come along and just see what you think of it. And I turned up and I met Tim, who is the creator of Time Team. And he put me in his car and he drove me to the top of a hill and then left me in a trench and drove off. Drove off. And I thought, wow, here I am. I've just been plonked here in the middle of an archaeological dig. And I was a bit nervous, actually, as well, because I didn't want to disrupt any of the important work that was going on by, you know, standing in the wrong place or saying something silly. But I just was able to watch what was going on. And then occasionally I'd go, so why are you sort of scraping like that? Or why is it that you can use a spade at this point, but you're having to use a trowel and a little brush at that point? And I think I was just so overwhelmed with the wonder of it all and just seeing this flurry of activity, you know, the digger working over there, Hilda in that trench, Helen in that trench. And it was just so interesting. And it gave me the hunger, I guess, to want to learn more about why this was happening and what was being learned and what the point of it was. So Doug, I think that's my answer, really. My favorite one was the first one, but there's been so many more besides now, and it's been really, really interesting. And I'm even more excited to go back again to Sutton Hoo, armed with a little bit more knowledge about what people are actually doing and why they're doing it. Was that a good answer, Helen? You're the one that's meant to be answering these questions, not me.
Well, I feel very grateful to Doug and to Conan, actually, because these are questions that I would like to ask you. But I feel that I can't really just go and pose my question in the Patreon, because that's not fair. I'm really interested to hear your answers. And I think it's so valuable for archaeologists to hear that bit of first impression. The first impression it's so fleeting, you know, and we need to know what people think, what people immediately think, because as a discipline, as a hobby or a profession or as a research topic, we're dependent on people finding it interesting. It can't just be for us. It's got to be for everybody. So we need to know what you think right at the start. What hooks you in? What puts you off?
Well, I've got a huge ream of Patreon supporters asking questions who tell me that they do indeed find it very, very interesting. So thank you for that. And let's get back to these Patreon questions. This comes in from Shannon, who says, I've always been somewhat confused by the British scheduled sites, which I think is a specific sort of designation of a site, isn't it? It's a scheduled monument, something that's a scheduled thing. Mm. And why, if they're not allowed to dig a site, is it allowed to be ploughed? Right. And Shannon goes on to say that she's been watching one of the old episodes, the Wynfarthing episode, which was this Anglo-Saxon cemetery that, Helen, you were sort of chiefly involved in. And you said that it was really sad to see that so much had been ploughed away with modern farming. So why are farmers allowed to do ploughing on a site where we know there's stuff underneath the soil?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because put like that, it does seem absolutely crazy. To tackle something about Wynfarthing, it wasn't actually scheduled. So scheduling's quite a high bar to become a scheduled monument, and Wynfarthing probably would never have fallen into that, because by the time we discovered it, it was already quite badly damaged by ploughing. Metal detecting finds in themselves are generally not enough to schedule a site, because we don't really know what's going on around it. So the answer really is that it's not considered reasonable to stop you doing what you have been doing in the past on your site when it becomes scheduled. To take a slightly weird example, but an example that might be more immediately understandable to most people, if your garden is on a scheduled site, say you live in somewhere like Caerwent, which is in the middle of a Roman town, and it becomes scheduled and you've been gardening, you've been planting bulbs, and you've been double digging your vegetable patch, you can carry on doing that, but that's all you can carry on doing. So if you want to dig a pond, if you want to do something new, you have to have special scheduled monument consent. But if you're just doing what you've always been doing, it's not considered reasonable to stop you. So it's the same with agriculture. If you've been ploughing a site, you can carry on. So if you've been ploughing it to a certain depth within the past 5 or 6 years, you can carry on doing that as long as you don't go any deeper and you don't start doing things like grubbing up hedges. You'd need specific consent for that. There may also be another aspect to it, which means it's so that you don't lose out by telling the state that you've got an exciting site on your land. There are lots of sanctions for if you've got a scheduled site that you bulldoze away. But if you bulldozed it away before it was scheduled, you wouldn't be doing anything wrong. And so it's to give you as much of an incentive as a farmer, as a landowner, that we can to get you to preserve a site until it can be scheduled. We end up with something that looks a bit weird, but it's a practical, pragmatic solution.
Yeah, hopefully that answers or goes a little way to answering your question, Shannon. But I think the sort of it's complicated, basically, is the ultimate thing of it. Final question, and I think this is my favourite. I think Connie here wins the prize, not that there is a prize, but would win the prize if there was one, for having my favourite question of the episode, which is, if I wanted to bury an item that could be found in 1,000 years, what is the best material that the container should be made of? If you're planning a time capsule, listen up, because we are using the discoveries of the past to inform this answer. If you want to bury something in the ground that is going to last forever and ever and ever, what do you need to put it in?
That is a really, really good question. And I am assuming that we're just burying it in what you might call a kind of perfectly ordinary average environment. We're not burying it in a bog, because so much survives in a bog. Butter survives in a bog. Wood survives in a bog. Everything survives in a bog. Skin, leather.
Yeah, that's a good point. Can I have a go at answering this? You can tell me how close I would be.
Yep.
You want something that isn't going to react with anything.
Ooh.
So you want... Is that right?
Not exactly. Carry on. Because you do want it to react with some things.
Oh, do you? Okay. Because I was going to say, obviously you wouldn't be able to afford this, but if you could, you'd want to bury it in like solid gold. Because gold is well known for not reacting with anything. That's why you find gold just sort of, you can like pan for gold because it doesn't react with anything. You can find just gold on its own. And so if you put things in gold, they won't react with all of the chemicals and the elements in the soil or the water and things like that. Am I getting close here?
Well, yes, you probably are, because actually I was just about to take issue with you there, Martin, because what I think is that you want to have something that reacts to the extent that it's antibacterial. With a copper alloy, as that corrodes, it provides you with these copper salts that are toxic to bacteria. And that's why textile and so on survives really well when it's in contact with copper alloy. But when you said gold, you know, I hadn't thought of that, because gold has got some kind of antibacterial thing, hasn't it? That's why it's used for false teeth. There is a certain amount of antibacterial stuff that goes on with gold. I'm really at the limits of my knowledge here. but I hadn't actually thought of gold, probably because
it's not really practical, is it? It's not a real, it's not, yeah.
So then I thought then of plastic, but I think we don't know enough about plastic. We don't know enough about how it degrades. So we think of plastic, you know, when we think about microplastics and single-use plastics and so on, we think that it's an inert material that stays around forever, but it probably doesn't. It stays around for a very long time, but it degrades and it breaks and it fractures. And so I would avoid plastic, I think, simply because we don't have the long-term data that we need on it. So what's your next suggestion then? So we've done gold, plastic, and...
I would just say then... something like lead or concrete.
Oh, gosh.
You know, something very, very dense.
Yes. I think lead is a great idea because that, again, it's toxic. So it stops the bacteria that will degrade, will attack, will cause rot. You know, so if you have a time capsule that includes anything organic, the lead will help to preserve that. And that's not terribly expensive and it's quite easy to make. And that may be something that's at the root of why coffins, like at the time team we did at Broughton, why really high status coffins can be lined with lead, because it's got that kind of preservation and permanence thing. Concrete, I would say, is too much like plastic. We don't know how concrete is going to behave, how modern concrete is going to behave. We've seen that with concrete cancer, they used to call it, didn't they? And more recently, we've had aerated concrete. It doesn't survive above ground in the way we thought it was going to, and so it probably won't survive below ground. Well, what about pottery, though?
Oh, because there we go. That's the
pottery
answer.
Pottery is one of those
That's
things.
That's always everywhere.
It never rots.
That's it.
Yeah, it never rots. It doesn't corrode. I once asked a conservator, what should we be doing to ensure that our pottery doesn't degrade on display in a museum? And she said, nothing. It's tough as old boots. You don't have to worry about it. No light measures, no humidity measures, nothing. Pottery will never change as long as it's hard-fired enough. But on the negative side, it will also not protect anything else. It is completely non-toxic. So I think, in the end, a copper alloy or a lead, and I would go for a copper alloy simply because the corrosion is slower. So anything that you had on your vessel, like a decoration or an inscription saying who had buried it and when, that is more likely to survive well than on lead. But I think the answer really is the ideal time capsule would be a little experiment. Make six. Make a silver, a lead, a copper. Make a pottery, a plastic, and a concrete, and maybe a stone, maybe seven. And then in the future, somebody will be able to use that to finish your experiment and have the definitive answer of what is the best material for a time capsule.
Connie, I'd be very interested to know. I quite like the idea that you are actually going to do this. So please let me know what you're putting in your copper alloy or other material that you're putting in the ground. We'd be interested to know about that. Yeah, you win the prize for having the best question. Thank you, though, if you've got in touch with any questions that we've featured in this podcast. We'll do it all again very soon.
Next week, you'll learn more about Sutton Hoo's famous Byzantine bucket ahead of our return there. And Martin is taking a trip to an Iron Age hill fort where there's a race against time before it's destroyed by vandals.
Yeah, more of the dark side, I'm afraid, of some of the practices that go on. All that plus more input from you, our Time Team community. We'll speak to you next time.
Goodbye.